From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
What has happened at the platform committee is not simply unfortunate, it is unfair. Unfair to the majority of Republicans who will not be attending this convention, but who registered a desire to see the constitutional amendment plank removed when they were queried in exit polls as they left the presidential primaries that nominated Bob Dole.
California Governor Pete Wilson and pro-choice Republicans threatened to take their fight to the convention floor. A Georgia teenager is charged with subversion for distributing an anarchist pamphlet. And the CIA investigates whether the agency and Bill Clinton as governor allowed an Arkansas airstrip to be used for illegal drug smuggling and illegal arms shipments to the Contras. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now!, Public Broadcasting's only daily election show. I'm Amy Goodman. Fresh efforts are underway to mollify pro-choice Republicans threatening to take the party's abortion angst to the floor at next week's convention. Massachusetts Governor William Weld said today the jury is still out on whether we can come together. He said it's pay me now or pay me later. We can either have an agreement for a minority report this week or we can have a floor fight next week. Weld is one of several GOP governors who want a tolerance provision added to the party's anti-abortion platform. A leading fighter for the tough anti-abortion language, Bea Buchanan, sister of holdout presidential candidate Pat Buchanan, says that she doesn't think the abortion rights delegates have the numbers to gain a minority report. She said Weld said that he only has 10%. If he can get 25% of the needed delegates, he can get that minority report. In addition to Weld, several other governors are warning of a possible floor fight if the party does not do more to accommodate abortion rights supporters. California Governor Pete Wilson says that unfortunately may be the only option. He declared the GOP's existing abortion language could scarcely be less open. And New Jersey Governor Christy Todd Whitman said if there is a floor fight, New Jersey will be there. Meanwhile, Republican voters in Kansas, Michigan, and Georgia chose Senate nominees who oppose abortion over candidates who back abortion rights in a stunning rebuke to moderates calling for tolerance. Less than a week before the start of the party's national convention. In Bob Dole's home state, the GOP contest pitted Republican moderates aligned with the woman who succeeded him against the party's social conservatives, and the conservatives won easily. And finally, federal judges decided that the redrawing of three unconstitutional congressional districts in Texas could not wait until the legislature meets again next year, so they redrew the boundaries themselves. But to reconfigure three districts the U.S. Supreme Court said were illegal, the panel of judges had to redraw 13 of the state's 30 districts. The judges also threw out primary results and ordered new elections for the fall, throwing Texas politics into turmoil. And you're listening to Democracy Now! Now, in front of me, I am looking at a pamphlet. It begins with a fist, and it says, Rise Above, Anarchy and Peace. Another of the pages has addresses of the Anti-Nazi League, the International Concern Friends and Family of Mumia Abu-Jamal, Hobos from Hell in Santa Cruz, California, Refuse and Resist, and We Tend to Offend. On another page, there are two recipes. One is for soy milk, and the other is for a Molotov cocktail, although at the top of this page it says, those who give and follow orders to kill innocent people deserve no respect. And the pages go on from there. This is the pamphlet of a young man who's 18 years old. His name is Jason Paul Moreland. He's from Georgia, and he is facing 20 years in prison if he's convicted of subversion. Jason Paul Moreland was arrested last week for distributing a homemade pamphlet that authorities say advocates the overthrow of the U.S. government. Joining us to talk about his case is his criminal defense attorney, Ed Tanner. He represents Jason. Welcome to Democracy Now! Why don't we start by you telling us what this case is about? How has he been charged with subversion? Under what law?
He's been charged with advocating the overthrow of the government. It's a Georgia statute that was enacted in 1968. And is possibly overly broad, at least very broad.
Subversion laws, are they common?
Well, I can tell you that this law has been on the books for 28 years since 1968, and there have been no prosecutions that we can find under the statute.
Do you know why the subversion law was instituted in 1968?
Well, I was in high school, but if I had to guess, I would say it was as a reaction to the protests against the Vietnam War, against the black militant groups at the time.
So how did the police get their hands on this pamphlet? And did Jason put it together himself? Has he been passing it out for a while?
Well, from the officer's testimony at the preliminary hearing, it appears that somehow somebody was distributing 30 copies of this pamphlet in May at a rock club. The police officer who testified said that he became aware of the pamphlet in July when another officer gave him a copy that he had received from somebody at a Waffle House restaurant. So,
and it had
he was rather vague about
it. It had an address on it that where Jason could be reached.
Right.
Now Jason is sitting in jail?
Right.
So what happened? They came to his house and arrested him?
No, the police called his mother, and his mother said, Jason's on vacation. I'll get in touch with him. Jason came back from Florida and surrendered himself.
Hmm. We're also joined by Bert Wexler. He's a professor of law at American University, and he's been looking into subversion cases for a long time. How common are anti-subversion laws?
Nowadays, hardly at all. But for a period between, I'd say, mid 1920s until through the awful McCarthy period, they were common.
And in these last, 76 years, was it mainly communists who were charged under anti-subversion laws?
Yes. In fact, predominantly. Sometimes the Klan, sometimes the Nazis, but very rarely. It was almost invariably used against the left.
Now, what are we talking about here? I mean, this is a pamphlet. Jason presumably hasn't done anything. Is an anti-subversion law constitutional? I mean, doesn't it violate freedom of speech?
Just a little background on this. The United States Constitution and the freedom of speech in the First Amendment gave almost no protection whatever until 1931. The Supreme Court, not once in its history, upheld the First Amendment until 1931. I mean, that comes as a bit of a shock. So you might think of the First Amendment as an infant. And the law never supported, until 1931, never vigorously supported the First Amendment. That doesn't mean that there wasn't fantastic struggle by the people to enforce it. There was tremendous anti-government material against the British and then against the new revolutionary government, and all throughout our history by the abolitionists, by women, by labor, by political groups, both left and right. The First Amendment has always been the cudgel through which resisting groups, those who are not in power, try to empower themselves.
You know, when we were talking yesterday, Professor Wexler, you were telling me about a Kentucky case where a couple was charged with, what was it, anarchy or subversion?
Yeah, it was a sedition, which is, you know, very much the same. It's Carl and Ann Braden, very, very famous white civil rights leaders. They were asked by a guy named Andrew Wade to buy a house for them in a white part of Lexington, Kentucky. And they did, and after they bought it, they just turned the keys over to him, and it was really his money.
He was African American.
Yes, yes, and they indicted them both for subversion or sedition, really sedition, trying to overthrow the government of the state of Kentucky. And they were convicted, and they won on the United States Court of Appeals. In the Kentucky Court of Appeals. But that's really, really interesting too. That we have here sedition laws being used against people who are trying, who are very much engaged in civil rights. And that was also true of the federal government when they indicted in the 1950s. Indicted people on the left, especially communists, during the Cold War, and many of those people were involved in civil rights and peace movement.
Let me go back for a second to Ed Tanner, and can you tell us a little about who Jason Moreland is, this 18-year-old who's now sitting in jail?
He's an 18-year-old kid who's worked just jobs like as a fry cook and things like that. He's a very respectful young man. He's quiet. Poses no threat that I can see.
Were you surprised to hear about this case? How were you contacted?
I was on vacation. I was surprised that a pamphlet such as this would cause an uproar in 1996. I've seen thousands of pamphlets, and I've seen the same literature printed, because all the literature in the pamphlets was taken from other publications that have been around for 25, 30 years. So yeah. There was no new thought, no new anything, and I don't understand the uproar.
You know, I see two of the pages are a standard leaflet that I have seen many times called Free Mumia Abu Jamal, Mumia Must Have a Free Trial, and it's two tight pages that he
right.
includes in this. And it does seem like a potpourri of all different pamphlets that he pulled together with one staple, I think you could say.
Mm-hmm.
Now, but let me ask you, what about that page that has the recipe for soy milk and for a Molotov cocktail?
Well, the Molotov cocktail recipe is taken from the Anarchist Cookbook that I believe William Powell or David Miller put out in 1971. And you can get that information off the Internet. It's no big secret, and they're easy to make. Any probably 10-year-old kid could make one. Jason Nowhere advocates using one. It's merely a recipe.
Professor Wexler, wasn't there a case of the Progressive magazine publishing the How to Make an Atomic Bomb?
Yes, there was such a case, and it was successful down below against the Progressive magazine, and when it was on appeal, the United States government dropped it, knowing full well that they could not win it. By the way, in terms of winning and losing, I want to say, as I said to his co-counsel, yeah, yesterday over the phone, their chance of losing this case is one in a million. I almost never say this, but this is an outrageous.
You mean winning the case?
I'm sorry. The state government's possibility of winning this case are nil. I mean, when it goes up, in other words, ultimately on appeal, it's just so completely contrary to federal law, which is Brandenburg versus Ohio around 1968 or 69, which says there must be imminent lawless action likely to produce such action, inciting it. Well, there's no inciting here. There's nothing imminent. It's a.
What was that Brandenburg case?
Brandenburg was a case of the Klan. The members of the Klan indicted for giving some speeches. And in that case, the Supreme Court gave what is now the current law. And that is, you are entitled to say, in the area of sedition, subversion, overthrowing the government, whatever, anything you wish, as long as it does not incite imminent lawless action likely to produce such action. And that's clearly nothing to do with this case. And Brandenburg is the case on which these fine lawyers could not, if you'll excuse me, possibly lose.
Ed Tanner. Was Jason arrested on the day of the bombing at the Olympics?
Day after. I believe that the alert for him was put out on the day of the bombing. His mom was contacted that day, and the following day, Jason drove back from Florida and turned himself in.
And did the police contend that he had anything to do with it?
Not to my knowledge. The police officer who testified at the preliminary hearing said that a general concern over the type of action that happened at Centennial Park may have played some part in his decision to coincidentally act on the day of the bombing, but that wasn't his reason for seeking out Jason.
Now,
I don't understand that answer.
Now, Professor Wexler, while you say they don't have a prayer of winning this case, the fact is that Jason is sitting in jail and has been since that first day. So there is a punishment here.
Yeah, I'm curious. What about bail? Is he out on bail?
His bond was set and then later reduced, and I am not aware whether or not his family has been able to make bond.
Oh, there's no doubt he'll pay a heavy price. Sitting in jail, paying for the attorneys, it's an awful thing. By the way, I didn't wish in any way to demean the two attorneys who are defending this case. On the contrary, I want to congratulate them. They are now engaged in the most important role I think lawyers can perform, and that is the defense of the First Amendment, which I think is the most important part of the United States Constitution. And I doff my hat to both of them.
We're talking to Professor Bert Wexler, professor of law at American University here in Washington, D.C. Also, Ed Tanner joins us in line. He's the criminal defense attorney representing Jason Moreland, the 18-year-old who's sitting in jail now outside of Atlanta, Georgia, who could face 20 years in prison if he's convicted of subversion. He was passing out and making available to people this pamphlet, a sort of amalgam of different pamphlets that many people have seen over the years, an anarchist pamphlet, and he does call himself an anarchist. I guess one question that I think probably a lot of people have is, does he understand the history behind what it is that he's doing? Does he understand what has happened to people over the years? Ed Tanner, how political is he?
Well, I can't speak to his knowledge except that he does have literature that he has read and studied. I think it's a whatever his beliefs are, they are sincere, and I think that he has come to a reasoned conclusion about his political beliefs at this stage of his life. I don't think he's some hot-headed, antisocial, dysfunctional child. He just doesn't think that the government serves his purposes or understands the individual's needs. It's a common school of thought.
I would think that his feelings are being reinforced right now. I'm looking at one page, Stand Up and Fight, and under it says, Police State America. On another page, there's a picture of a man mopping the floor, and he writes next to it, I'd rather be flag burning.
Well, I don't imagine this is doing anything to socialize Jason right now.
Well, you're saying that you think there's no question, Professor Wexler, that this case is going to be won by Jason. But
not necessarily below. They may take a series of appeals. But ultimately, if it gets anywhere into the federal judiciary, and I would think even the state Supreme Court, there's no chance of losing this.
But let me ask you this. The counterterrorism law has just been passed, and the Congress is voting on actually strengthening that law, making it more restrictive. Does that change any of the laws that you think are now in place, and doesn't different atmospheres make for different conclusions and results of these kind of cases?
But the general atmosphere on the First Amendment and other matters in this country is really dreadful today. But I think there are serious doubts about the constitutionality of certain parts of the anti-terrorism bill. And happily, I haven't seen the bill yet. Happily, as I understand it, the awful wiretap aspects have been deleted by pressures from both left and right, and by both liberal and conservative congressmen. So I think the anti-terrorism bill itself has been partly defanged, but it needs a little more defanging. But I don't think that will, the fact that Congress passed the anti-terrorism bill, I don't think will affect the fine chances that these two lawyers have for winning their case.
Attorney Ed Tanner, do you know if the militia men who were arrested just before the Olympics in Georgia, also the Viper militia in Arizona, were they charged with subversion?
Yeah, I'm not sure. They were charged. I think they were both arrested under federal law. In this case, it's strictly a state case.
Well, it's interesting that with all the militia activity going on today, and that involves, you know, weapons and other things, that it's an 18-year-old anarchist who puts out a pamphlet that is charged with subversion.
It is interesting.
Have you gotten any response from the Justice Department, Ed Tanner?
No. The only people I've spoken with other than the person who's actually Moore's lead counsel right now, Pete Whitlock, he and I have spoken with the local chapter of the ACLU, and they provided us with some helpful information, but we've heard nothing from anybody that wants to prosecute Jason other than Clayton County.
Where do you go from here? What's the next step in Jason Moreland's case?
Well, the case has been bound over as a felony from preliminary hearing. It'll be sent to the DA's office for investigation. The DA's office will make an independent investigation beyond that which the police department's made, and try to see if there's any ground whatsoever for bringing this case in front of a grand jury, for a grand jury to consider whether or not Jason should be indicted for this charge. And if he is, then it goes to arraignment, then to trial.
Professor Wexler, from your own experience, do you think they're just trying to scare an 18-year-old kid, or do you think they're serious?
I don't know. I just want to repeat what I think has already been said, that this was passed in 68. That was the height of massive resistance to the desegregation laws, and it was obviously aimed at the NAACP and black and white, the interracial groups fighting to desegregate the schools. And I think we ought to bear that in mind, what a dangerous kind of law it is that was trying to stop the end of apartheid in this country, and this is just a follow-up in a different, slightly different area.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for joining us, Professor Burt Wexler, a professor of law here at American University in Washington, D.C., and Ed Tanner, one of the attorneys representing Jason Moreland, Jason Paul Moreland, 18 years old, who faces 20 years in prison and a $20,000 fine for subversion. That's for giving out an anarchist pamphlet. You're listening to Democracy Now! Up next, we're going to be going out to the San Diego Convention. We're going to be finding out what other young people think in this country. And finally, we'll be taking a look at the Mena Air Base, airstrip in the 1980s, that's in Arkansas, under Governor Bill Clinton, and what the CIA is investigating. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Democracy Now! Is Pacifica Radio's daily grassroots election show. The 1992 elections marked the first time in recent years that candidates and campaigns actively sought out the youth vote. Lest we forget that defining moment on MTV when then-candidate Clinton answered the question that America's young people were allegedly dying to know— does he wear boxers or briefs? Underwear aside, a new poll released today reveals that the majority of the under 30 voting crowd feels that Washington policymakers have the wrong priorities. Now, I wouldn't say the majority of young people feel the way Jason Paul Moreland does, at least according to this poll. Robin Keola joins us. She's the co-director of 2020 Vision, which is a national nonprofit group that is trying to revitalize the democratic process by encouraging people to take 20 minutes each month to take action to protect the environment and promote peace. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy.
So tell us about this poll and the results.
Great, I'd be happy to. Well, just to start off, we just launched a project this election year to educate young people about the issues that concern them and about the votes of their elected officials and how the young people can make their voices heard. And before we launched this project, we wanted to gain insight into young people's budget priorities and what they expect from their leaders. Other polls had been done of young people, but not specifically about budget priorities. And what we found was really interesting. To start out, more young people are registered as Republicans, which we found was really...
Really? What's the percentage of you?
40% Republican, 33% Democrat, and 21% Independent.
And, of course, this is of young people have registered.
Yeah, and it's 18 to 30-year-olds.
How many young people who can register haven't? What is the percentage? Do you know?
We didn't survey on that. Mm-hmm. But regardless of political affiliation, the priorities of young people are very clear. And their top concerns facing the country, number one was improving education. And the second was crime and drugs, fighting crime and drugs. Now, interestingly, what young people think is the least important problem is maintaining a strong defense. And because of this, they consider defense spending a very low budget priority. 62% felt in 1995 that the defense budget was way too high. And for those people who don't know, the defense budget was $275 billion in 1995. 71% of young people opposed the budget add-on that Congress just added on, $11 billion, to above and beyond what the experts at the Pentagon say that they need for maintaining a strong
defense.
That's
particularly interesting, especially if they identify themselves as Republicans, because Republicans have traditionally very much supported the military.
Right, and this is across party lines. This is pretty overwhelming. And just interestingly, young people only thought the defense budget to begin with was one-third the size of it that it actually is. $90 billion was the average guess. So basically, and one thing that people should know is that only 58% actually have a very favorable rating of the Defense Department, which is just interesting. So it's not really an anti-defense sentiment. And also 45% of young people either themselves had been in the military or somebody in their household had been, the people we polled, which we thought was really high as well.
45%?
45%, either themselves or somebody in their household.
Where did you get the people that you polled?
It was a random sample. The Melman Group, based in Washington, conducted the poll for us.
And why did you decide to do a poll? I mean, a lot of people think polls are basically a waste of time.
Well, we wanted to identify the budget priorities so that we can educate people on these issues and encourage them to get involved, both in voting but also after the elections, to hold their members accountable, those that get elected. So, and another interesting thing that we found was that young people really want to see a rise in education funding, and 77% of young people are willing to cut defense spending to do that.
That's very interesting. I'm looking at your first question. The most important problem facing the country is improving education, 32%, fighting crime and drugs, 28%, maintaining a strong national defense, 3%.
Exactly. Yep.
We're talking to Robin Keola, and she is with the group 2020 Vision. Now, who do you represent? What is 2020 Vision?
As you said, it's a grassroots organization. We're dedicated to revitalizing democracy, and we do this by informing and making it simple for people to take action each month. Our subscribers, and we have 30,000 across the country, get an action alert each month giving them background on an issue and a simple action that they can take. And the action is usually writing or calling a decision maker on a critical issue. We focus both on environmental and peace issues.
Now, I'm looking at your board of directors, and it's got people from Friends of the Earth, people from People for the American Way,
mm-hmm.
and others. Someone called recently who heard about this poll and said they were really surprised that jobs and the economy were not in the top three of
mm-hmm.
concerns of young people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's interesting. And the other thing that I found really interesting, given that Dole's budget balancing announcement he made the other day, was that young people weren't overwhelmingly in support of holding down taxes either. And since that was the backbone of his platform, it's just kind of interesting. And one other thing that just ranked very highly among young people is that they're not just concerned with things that affect them personally. Their concerns cross generation. Social Security, for example, 85% are not willing to cut Social Security to balance the budget, and 78% weren't willing to cut Medicare to balance the budget. So it's not just the things that affect them here and now. They're really thinking for their future. They're thinking about their parents. They're thinking about their kids.
Do you know the racial breakdown or the economic breakdown of the kids that you surveyed?
I do have that. It was, we did both
okay,
education.
Okay, I call kids under 30. I call them all kids.
2% had not graduated high school. 35% had just a high school graduate. 32 had some college. 24 had graduated college. And only 7% had post-graduate training.
Mm-hmm. And racial breakdown?
I don't have the racial breakdown. We didn't poll on that. But we did... We did do financial breakdown.
What does 2020 Vision plan to do from here on in, now that you have this information?
Well, we hope to educate young people on these issues that concern them. And to do that, we have set up an 800 number that both young people and all people can call to learn about what congressional district is they're in, how their members have been voting on this issue, the voting records, and to get an immediate action that they can take to both looking forward to voting and to holding their members accountable. And that number is 888-CUT-PORK. For those people who don't have a Touchtone phone, it's 888-288-7675.
I like that. 888-CUT-PORK.
We also have a worldwide web page that people can go to, both to get the poll results and also to get an action that they can take. And that's www.2020vision.org.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Robin Keola, for joining us this morning. She is from 2020 Vision, and the report is coming out today that looks at youth priorities. And no, the military budget is not one of them. And yes, education is. You're listening to Democracy Now! Well, Republicans could be headed towards a floor fight over the issue of abortion. Pacifica National Affairs correspondent Larry Bensky is in San Diego, and he's been covering the GOP platform hearings. Larry, there's a lot going on.
There's a lot going on, Amy, and it may, as you say, lead to a floor fight. Yesterday, as the Republicans finally got to discussing the question of reproductive choice at around 4:30 in the afternoon, just as they were beginning that discussion, the full platform committee, this time 107 members, across the hall in the Concourse Center here in San Diego, a press conference began, curiously timed to take all the media out of the room where the actual hearings were, a press conference held by California Governor Pete Wilson. And Governor Wilson made it clear that he is not happy with the removal of the tolerance language from the platform, which was done by a subcommittee, as we reported yesterday on Monday, that he intends to do all that he can to try to get it restored, and that if it isn't restored, he basically threatened a floor fight next week. And as we said yesterday, the last thing in the world that the Republicans want is a floor fight over this issue on primetime television in front of the American people.
We're talking to Larry Bensky, who's out at the San Diego Convention, and certainly a lot has been happening there. Christy Todd Whitman, the governor of New Jersey, William Weld, the governor of Massachusetts, and of course, you're just saying Pete Wilson. They're saying there will be a floor fight, but we have a report that Babe Buchanan is saying they can get a minority, they want this minority report if they have 20% of the delegates supporting it, and that she says, according to William Weld, they only have 10%, and that's the only thing that would avoid that floor fight.
It's very difficult to tell who the delegates are and what they believe, Amy. We're getting conflicting reports on this. We had a survey a couple of days ago before the platform committee hearings actually began that was done by five national newspapers, including the Los Angeles Times and the San Diego Union, saying that something like 34% of the delegates, so almost 2,000 delegates who will be here next week, are pro-choice. Today, the New York Times CBS poll says that only 28% favor a tolerance plank. But one thing is clear. That the platform committee is definitely wired in favor of the anti-abortion forces. It's chaired by Henry Hyde, who is author of the Hyde Amendment, which, of course, many years ago denied federal funding for abortions to poor women. It is voting repeatedly yesterday against any kind of pro-choice positions. In one recorded vote, the vote on the measure that Governor Wilson had brought with him in that press conference yesterday, the pro-choice voices were only able to get 12 votes out of 107 for that substitute language.
Were there prayers being said at the GOP convention platform meetings?
There's definitely a serious religious right nature to the delegates who are here on the platform committee and who will be coming next week as well, as you will see when you get here. The person who seems to basically be driving the delegates, whipping the delegates, as they say in parliamentary terms, is Ralph Reed. He's out in the hallway. He boasts that he has portable computers that will be inside the delegations when they're in the hall. He'll be able to instantly whip votes on any measure that may come to the floor. Delegates look to him for leadership. And with Ralph Reed and Phyllis Schlafly and Gary Bauer and Babe Buchanan, standing out there basically calling the shots, you can pretty much see for yourself what the ideological cast of this convention is.
Now, yesterday, Bob Dole addressed the delegates. What did he have to say to them? I think it was by videotape. Is that right? By satellite?
It was by live satellite.
Yeah.
He didn't have hardly anything to say that we hadn't heard before. He talked mostly about his economic plan. But, Amy, I've watched him talk many times over the years, and I've rarely seen him look so pained and tense and drawn as he did yesterday.
Yet he didn't make a case for tolerance?
He didn't mention the whole issue. He did not mention the whole issue, which, of course, is all that anyone around here is talking about. The Republicans are already furious about this. Newt Gingrich was here yesterday, and he was saying, why aren't you concentrating on the Democrats? Why are you beating up on us about abortion and tolerance? As I say, Governor Wilson emerges as a major player in this. He has control of his California delegation. And as we were saying yesterday, it takes six delegations out of the 50 in order to bring a measure on the platform to the floor. Here's what a little bit of what Governor Wilson said yesterday in that press conference that he held to take the play away from the platform committee hearings across the hall.
My view may very well be the minority inside this convention hall. It is the majority outside the convention hall. But more important, if we are to be understood to be an inclusive party, the platform should be inclusive. And as it stands now, it is not. I would simply say that there are many of us who urge, while there is still time, that the platform be changed. Not that we are urging anyone who is pro-life to abandon their position. To the contrary, we would not do that. What we are saying is that they have an obligation to the rest of us to make that platform at least inclusive enough to reflect a minority view. I hope they will do that because there are much better ways for us to spend our time on the floor of the convention and off than by engaging in a floor fight.
Will you lead a floor fight if you lose the platform level?
We shouldn't have to get to that point. Nobody who is pro-choice is urging that we have a floor fight. To the contrary, they are urging that we avoid a floor fight. But that, unhappily, may be the only option if the platform committee does not seek to accommodate this view.
Governor Pete Wilson speaking yesterday. The wire services are reporting this morning, Amy, that Governor William Weld of Massachusetts says that they now have eight delegations, or the leaders of eight delegations, who say they would support a floor fight and all they need is six.
Well, we will certainly be there next week. We're going to be broadcasting live from the convention every morning for 2 hours, so we'll be following this, whatever does happen. Now, Larry, in related news, there were three primaries in Kansas, Michigan, and Georgia yesterday, and it looks like the anti-choice forces took all three races. From Kansas, the replacement for Bob Dole, Congressmember Sam Brownback, an outspoken leader of the 95 freshman class, defeated Senator Sheila Fromm. Of course, she was only senator for a few weeks. She was appointed to replace Dole. What do you make of this?
Well, I make of this that this is coming up to be what I've called for a long time, Amy, the election of the century. We are going to have a clear-cut choice in 1996 between the forces of the Christian right, who now run the Republican Party, and the so-called moderates who dominate the electorate, we are told. Not only, as you said, did Sam Brownback, one of the most right-wing members of the Republicans' 1994 freshman delegation, win the nomination for Republican candidate for the Senate in Kansas, but Rona Romney, who's a very right-wing woman in Michigan, won the nomination to oppose Senator Carl Levin there. And
a Detroit radio talk show host, no less.
Exactly. There's hope for us on the radio, how we can go into politics, especially if we're right-wing, of course. There's no hope if you're not. Guy Milner won in Georgia, defeating Johnny Isaacson. That's, by the way, good news for the Democrats, because Max Cleland, who is the Georgia Secretary of State, is quite popular down there, and the Democrats will have a clear-cut candidate choice between a moderate and a right-winger there to replace Senator Sam Nunn. Interestingly enough, Jim Ryan, the former Olympic athlete, won the Republican nomination for Brownback's seat that Brownback is giving up in Kansas. So you have the moderates, so-called, the Nancy Kassebaums and Bob Dole, if you can think of him as a moderate, losing their hold. No, you can't. And that's the whole thing, Amy, that you've mentioned before, and we've talked about here before. You know, you're talking about moderates now. You're talking about Pete Wilson as a moderate. If you watch his record in California, a lot of people out here would say that he's lost no opportunity throughout his governorship to beat up on poor people, on welfare people, and on immigrants. He's now being thought of as a moderate. Governor Pataki is a moderate in New York. You know, this type of thing. The whole nature of the dialogue in the establishment press has shifted so far to the right that in order to find moderates, they are setting these people up in an antagonism against the far, far right. But we do have that kind of contest taking place over and over again, and especially here in San Diego. And we'll continue to follow it today. They're going back into the platform committee again to settle such issues as do they want to advocate amending the Constitution so that children born in the United States of illegal immigrants will no longer be citizens. That's been a constitutional protectorate since the Constitution was established. That would take citizenship away from children in this country who are born to those who are not citizens.
Larry, we do have to wrap up, but there's one other major news item that came up yesterday relating to the Republican convention, not to mention Democrats as well, and that is the redistricting going on in Texas. The fact that federal judges decided that the redrawing of three unconstitutional congressional districts in Texas couldn't wait until the legislature meets again next year, so they're redrawing the boundaries around them, which will affect 13 of the state's 30 districts, and they're throwing out all the primary results in order to have new elections in the fall.
This is bad news for Democrats, of course, but it also sets up an intriguing possibility, Amy, for this election year, and that is that after the November election is over, we may still not know who will control the House of Representatives next year, because if it is close and there are still runoffs scheduled in those Texas districts, if nobody gets 50% in one of those new districts that you're talking about, there will be runoffs in December. It's a possibility that you might have 5, 6, 7 runoffs happening in Texas, that 5, 6, 7 seats holds the balance of the House of Representatives, and thereby we would not know until December who would control Congress.
Hmm. So all eyes will be watching, and for those who feel that there is a difference between Democrats and Republicans, and certainly on the issue of choice, there clearly is. Well, Larry, I want to thank you very much for joining us, and we'll be talking to you tomorrow to get an update on all those things that they're going to be talking about today. You're listening to Democracy Now! Up next, we take a look at the MENA airstrip in Arkansas, its relation to then-Governor Bill Clinton and the CIA. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now!, the program that dares to ask the questions the corporate media doesn't. I'm Amy Goodman. The CIA's Inspector General has launched an investigation into allegations that when Bill Clinton was governor of Arkansas, the CIA used an isolated airstrip in MENA, Arkansas, to ship arms illegally to the Nicaraguan Contras and deliver large shipments of cocaine to the United States. The White House says the MENA story is manufactured by a right-wing conspiracy, but the CIA is investigating the charges and is expected to deliver a report later this summer or in early fall. Now, on Monday, I had a chance to question Press Secretary Mike McCurry about the CIA investigation, and this is what he had to say.
Yeah. Speaking of drugs, over the weekend, a CIA spokesperson said John Deutsch is going to be investigating what went on at MENA Air Force Base in Arkansas during the 1980s, looking at he's going to be looking at.
I don't believe that's true. I don't believe a spokesman said that on
ESPN. Yeah, a spokesperson said that on Sunday.
Well, I saw that reported in a news magazine, but I'm not certain that that's what he said, but you can check it, the CIA. But
said that they're going to be looking at drug smuggling there and also the illegal shipping of arms to the Contras while President Clinton was governor of Arkansas. Does President Clinton have any comment on that?
I don't believe that they're looking at anything specifically related to Governor Clinton at the time, Governor Clinton. But I'll refer you to the CAI for what they may have said. I'm not sure that you're characterizing it correctly. Yes.
And that was Mike McCurry's response on Monday. Then Leon Panetta got up, the chief of staff, to respond to Bob Dole's speech on tax cuts. And after he finished, Mike McCurry came back to the podium, and this is what he had to say.
I've checked in the meantime with the CIA. They have, for about 3 or 4 months, at the request of Congressman Leach, been looking into a series of specific questions that he put to the agency. There was nothing, and not that anything I'm aware of that was new about that. They had acknowledged some time ago that they were pursuing those allegations. I'm not aware of anything about those allegations that would suggest a response from the White House is needed.
So the question is Bill Clinton, as governor of Arkansas in the 1980s, being investigated? Well, we're joined by journalist Bob Perry, who's editor of the Consortium, formerly with AP, Associated Press, longtime reporter, and Newsweek, and one of the first to break the story on the whole Iran-Contra scandal. Now, people may be saying, why are we talking about Iran-Contra in 1996 when this happened in the 1980s? Well, clearly the CIA is right now looking back at that time. Was Bill Clinton somehow involved, and why is the story cropping up again, Bob?
Well, it's cropping up again because Governor Clinton then is now President Clinton now. And ironically, many of the stories that we were trying to write about in the mid-80s, that is the problems with the Contra movement, Contra drugs, weapons flowing illegally to Central America, which many of the conservatives particularly rejected and attacked those stories at that time. Now, some of the same conservative groups, some of the same conservative media watchdogs are pressing those stories today because they may embarrass President Clinton.
So tell me about the story you broke in 1985, the response to it from the mainstream media. I mean, you were in the mainstream media.
Well, I was at the Associated Press in 1985, and we had already been doing stories about Oliver North's operations. We wrote the first story mentioning him in June of 85, and then we continued working on these pieces, and that led us, I was working with Brian Barger, who is now with CNN, and it led us to stories about Contra drug trafficking. And in the fall of 1985, Brian and I went down to Miami and then down to Central America and met with a number of people, including government officials there and DEA officials. We reviewed documents. We interviewed people in the White House who were aware that there were Contra drug problems. And we broke a story in December of 1985 saying that the Contra movement, both in Costa Rica and Honduras, where the Contras are based, both, you know, all major and even many minor Contra groups had been implicated in drug trafficking, that they were flying drugs up to the United States and using the profits to pay for some of the weapons. We knew even at that time that one of the people behind this was Manuel Noriega, who had been recruited by the CIA, by William Casey, and by Oliver North at the White House to assist the Contras in that period. This was a period when Congress was withdrawing support for the CIA operation there. So Noriega was recruited. He brought in his pilots. They were flying cocaine in, dropping off weapons. The Contra units were protecting their flights and assisting them in getting the flights up to the United States and also by ship into Miami. The main points where the drugs were coming in, though, was not MENA, Arkansas. The main points were in southern Florida and in California. It's believed that much of the crack trade in Los Angeles at that time was tied to Contra drug trafficking. Ships that the Contras were involved in were coming into Miami with loads of cocaine. There were flights allegedly being brought into airfields, Homestead Air Force Base in southern Florida, carrying cocaine. MENA was one of the outposts. When we wrote that story, though, in December of 85, we came under fierce attack. Many of the conservative groups denounced this. The Contras were then, of course, the founding fathers, according to Ronald Reagan's phrasing. So we had a hard time getting anybody to follow up on that story. When the one person in Congress who did was Senator John Kerry. Senator John Kerry began to dig into this, and that led him to Oliver North's operation as well. But all this was being denied. There was even a federal investigation that was begun in Miami by an assistant U.S. attorney named Jeffrey Feldman. And Feldman interviewed many of the same people we did. And he came up with a report urging the then U.S. attorney, Leon Kellner, to conduct a grand jury investigation of the Contras. This, of course, was not well received back in Washington. Ed Meese, who was then attorney general, flew down to Miami to talk to Kellner. Kellner then took Feldman's report, which urged a grand jury. It was rewritten without Feldman's knowledge or approval to say there was no need for a grand jury, that it was just a fishing expedition. Kellner signed Feldman's name to it, and then sent it up to Washington. When it arrived here in the spring of 1986, it was then leaked to the Republicans in Congress, who then used it against John Kerry and to try to stop his investigation. It was also given to the conservative media, the Washington Times, and so forth, and used against us. Barger and I were attacked on the front page of the Washington Times for writing these stories, and it had a real effect in terms of shutting down that whole line of inquiry, which continued, but against tremendous opposition from the Reagan-Bush administrations. That's why I find it kind of ironic that now, years later, because one of the outposts, and probably not even a major outpost, although certainly a significant one, in Mena, Arkansas, is now become the target of a great deal of conservative uproar. And I think the evidence that that Bill Clinton was somehow directly connected is fairly thin. He certainly should have done more, as should a lot of people in Washington and around the country, to stop this kind of drug trafficking, but he didn't.
What evidence is there that Governor Bill Clinton knew about the Mena airstrip? Now, I'm looking at Roger Morris's book. Larry Bensky interviewed Roger a couple of months ago on Democracy Now!, his book, Partners in Power, The Clintons and Their America. He says that by the sheer magnitude of the drugs and money that its flights generated, tiny Mena, Arkansas became in the 80s one of the world centers of the narcotics trade and the base of what many believed was the single largest cocaine smuggling operation in U.S. history. And this was under a CIA operative named Barry Seal, who was going in and out of Mena.
Well, I think that's overstating it, although I don't have the... It's hard to really give hard figures on how much of any illegal substance is brought in anywhere, because we don't really know. But there were huge shipments coming into South Florida, as I say, some by sea as well as by air, and into California. There was a so-called Frogman case that was carried out in San Francisco, where some of the defendants were Contra operatives. Money was found in cocaine. Profits were found in their property. So you had strong evidence of this kind of problem, but. But Mena was a place we had heard of. I'd interviewed one pilot named Heinrich Rupp, who was a very shady character and hard to believe, but he was the first one really who told me about Mena as a place not just for drugs, but for training. He said that the CIA liked the mountainous terrain around Mena because it was similar to the terrain that pilots would confront down in Central America. So they would train pilots there, and Barry Seal did use it. Barry Seal was being was used as a Contra CIA operative, and he was also used by DEA and CIA for investigations. If you remember, he was the one who tried to essentially create a case against the Sandinistas, who were then ruling Nicaragua. He flew in cocaine to Nicaragua. His plane, in that case, was shot down by Sandinista defense forces. He then flew another plane in to reload, to shift the drugs. Photographs of that reloading were then used by Oliver North and the Reagan administration to discredit the Sandinistas. The irony here was that in the midst of this effort to try to paint the Sandinistas as drug traffickers back in 84 and 85, when there's really very thin evidence that Nicaragua was used significantly at all at that time for cocaine trafficking, the Contras who were being supported by the CIA, were deeply involved in the cocaine trade. And Noriega, who had been recruited by the CIA to assist the Contras, was a major cocaine trafficker. This was the kind of gamesmanship that the conservative movement and that conservative administration played in the 80s, and now it's just being spun a different way.
Well, now, one of the characters that Roger Morris writes about and certainly has come up over the years is Dan Lassiter, who is a major contributor to Bill Clinton's gubernatorial campaigns. How was he connected to MENA?
Well, I'm not sure that's been very well drawn. I read both Mr. Morris's piece in Penthouse some months ago, and I was just reading his book last night after we talked. I just don't think that the Lassiter connection is particularly well drawn. There's no question that Mr. Lassiter was involved in possessing cocaine. He used cocaine and was arrested and convicted of that. But the linkages that are drawn are kind of thin.
Well, he makes the argument that a law enforcement person went to Clinton and said, "This is what's going on at MENA," and he said, "That's Lassiter's deal. Leave it alone."
Well, again, we're dealing with some of the Arkansas State Troopers. It's hard to know what to make of some of that testimony. One of the problems that we've had with the whole Whitewater story in terms of trying to deal with it honestly is that what happens often is that you'll have these troopers or disgruntled people in Arkansas who will go to Clinton opponents there. They will then be sent over to Floyd Brown at Citizens United. Floyd Brown is sort of a famous Republican opposition research person. He did the Willie Horton commercials, for instance. He will then talk to them. They'll refine their story, and then they're turned over to the news media with stories that implicate Clinton. It's too bad that this gets so muddied up, because I think there are things to criticize Clinton for very sharply over this. I think he should have done more to investigate MENA.
I mean, he knew about it.
Well, what we know that he knew was that the CIA was using this facility as part of its operation in Central America. He also certainly knew that the DEA was using Barry Seal to develop evidence against drug traffickers in Latin America. That was the operation which, while focused on the Medellin cartel, was then basically used to try to also discredit the Sandinistas. So we know that. But do we know that Bill Clinton was aware that illegal drugs were being brought in for illegal shipment to the American public? I don't think the evidence exists for that right now.
Did he convene a grand jury to investigate what was going on?
No, there was money set aside for that grand jury, and it was not convened. And I think that's where he certainly deserves criticism. But again, there were some honest people in Congress then. There was Bill Alexander, who was a Democratic congressman from Arkansas. Bill Alexander was trying to push this. He said, "There's a problem here." There were tremendous efforts by the conservatives in Washington at that time to discredit and destroy Alexander's career. Stories were leaked about him taking junkets and so forth, and his career was ended. So that was what happened to people who stood up. John Kerry, who in 86 was trying to look into these matters, was put under an ethics committee investigation by the Republican-controlled Senate at that time. These were the kinds of real political dangers that people faced. Now, Bill Clinton has never been accused of being particularly politically courageous. He's a person who wants to protect his political career. And I think he did not see a particular reason to go challenge the CIA and the White House and the Justice Department during the 80s over this kind of tough issue.
Now let's talk about this, what's happening right now. You have this odd situation where the Republicans are pushing for this investigation and linking it somehow to Whitewater, pushing the CIA to investigate what happened there, and particularly the links to Bill Clinton as governor in the 1980s in Arkansas. Yet, if this is dragged up, these, as you were saying, are the very people who did not want the story dragged up in the 1980s because it was their Republicans. It was Reagan, it was Bush, it was Oliver North. How do they launder the Republicans out of it to get Bill Clinton?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, certainly some of these videos that have been put out against Clinton, the Clinton Chronicles, for instance, will tell this story as if Oliver North, Ronald Reagan, George Bush, and the Contras weren't involved. It's simply that there were these drugs coming in and Bill Clinton was involved. So there's an effort by some of the conservatives to make this a Democratic scandal and cut the Republicans out. I think, though, serious people can't look at it that way. And I think that will be a problem for the Republicans. But again, some of us tried to deal with this when it was actually happening. when these drugs were being brought in to the United States to be sold to children and the rest of us. I mean, we did our jobs, and we were essentially attacked by the conservatives for doing our jobs. Now, 10 years after the fact, they want to use the issue politically. I find that very troubling.
Well, we'll see what happens. We'll have you back when the report comes out. The CIA supposedly will finish this report at the end of the summer. Bob Parry, so much to say, so little time. We will have you back. What is your 800 number if people would like to find out about your publication, The Consortium?
Well, the 800 number for The Consortium, if they're interested in getting a sample copy, is 1-800-738-1812.
One more time?
1-800-738-1812. And we are trying to deal with these kinds of questions, historical questions from the 80s.
Well, thanks again for joining us. Democracy Now! Is produced by Julie Drizin. Our engineer is Kenneth Mason. If you'd like a copy of today's show, a copy of the tape, you can call the Pacifica Archives at 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Or send us an email. You can send it to us at democracy@pacifica.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!